From the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., this is Update One, the club's official podcast. It features newsworthy stories originating from the NPC facilities, as well as broader topics related to journalism, communications, press freedom, and transparency.
Hello and welcome to Update One. I'm Bill Loveless, a member of the Broadcast and Podcast Committee here at the National Press Club. Joining me today in the club's studio is Miranda Spivak, a longtime journalist and the author of the book, Backroom Deals in Our Backyards, How Government Secrecy Harms Our Communities and the Local Heroes Fighting Back. Miranda, welcome to Update One.
Oh, thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here as well. The book is a good, solid read. I've really enjoyed it and learned a lot from it. You've been a journalist for many years, one steeped in investigative reporting. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your career.
So I started as the night police reporter in Portland, Maine. This used to be a traditional route. Of course, things have changed. And actually, there was a lot of access to the police themselves, to their reports, et cetera. But as I moved along and came back to Washington, where I grew up, the government was more remote. Partly it was bigger. It's not as intimate as a smaller city. But also, I think there was a lot of move towards putting things behind, you know, closed doors, and making it much harder for members of the public, to say nothing of journalists, to get information on issues that your tax money has already paid for.
Right. Gosh, you mentioned you started out as a police reporter. I did too. And I've often said over the years when I was an editor and hiring reporters that, boy, if you told me that you had once covered cops, I was really interested in you because it's one of the tougher beats to master. You
know? It is tough. And it also involves a lot of personal contact and source development, again, done in person, up close. And I think that's sort of a dying art, not that we're here to talk about the decline of the media, but that is a problem.
Well, we might touch on that before we're done. Yeah. You know, your book, Backroom Deals in Our Backyards, tells how Americans are likely to encounter the ill effects of government malfeasance and neglect close to home, but are often unable to get information about significant issues affecting their communities. Why is this so difficult?
Well, there are a number of reasons. The more benign reasons are that state and local governments are underfunded. And so if a legislator is going to choose between putting in more money for schools or doing more to make records more accessible, they're probably going to opt for schools. It's sort of the politically sound way to go. So that is one reason. Also, there's been a lot of privatization and outsourcing in state and local government following, frankly, what was started in the federal government around 1980 when Ronald Reagan was in office. And that has put a lot of information into the hands of private contractors who then often find ways to withhold it from the governments and from the public. So, there are a variety of reasons. Of course, there are, sneaky deals that are done behind closed doors that lawmakers don't want the public to know about. And that ranges from everything to development deals to abortion laws. There are really a lot of reasons for this. And not all are nefarious.
Yeah. Well, the book contains the stories, the fascinating stories of so-called accidental activists who questioned worrisome events in their communities involving pollution, cancer, hazardous roads, and other concerns in the face of what you describe as massive obstacles to information placed in their way by local and state officials. You call them accidental activists. Why so?
Well, I don't think anybody really signs up for this. I think what happens is that these people, like many people, find a problem in their communities. And so they go to their state government or their local government thinking, of course, they're going to get help. They've identified a problem. Surely the government is here to help them and solve the problem. But instead, again, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is defensiveness, they encounter an information blockade and then find just an astonishing amount of secrecy and reluctance by government officials to tell the public what's going on.
Yeah, and you describe these, you illustrate these challenges in a number of stories. They're striking stories. They're heart-wrenching stories. Among them is a fellow named Michael Hickey from Hoosick Falls, New York. Briefly tell us about Michael and the difficulties he faced his town.
Michael's very typical, actually, of the people that I ran into. They have absolutely no experience, you know, fighting their governments. They assume things are going to go well because this guy went to the mayor and said, I think we have a problem with our drinking water, and had noticed a lot of people having rare forms of cancer in their community,
including
his father, who died of a rare form of cancer. And instead, the mayor is like apparently a little freaked out and says, wow, if we tell the public about this, it's going to ruin our efforts to make our community a destination for, you know, people who want to live in a tiny little, very cute community. And so he goes beyond that. He says, well, you know, if you're not going to test the water, I'm going to find a way to get it tested. And he finds a lab and gets it tested at his own expense. And of course, it comes back with a very high concentration of forever chemicals, which at the time were not in the news that much, but now we know really how harmful they can be.
What period of time are we talking about?
You know, we're probably going back a decade, actually. And so, you know, he's a very shy, modest guy, actually. And again, you know, why am I in the midst of this, he's thinking. But nobody's stepping up. And so he is able to put pressure on the local government, on the county government, on the state government, and then he learns to use public records laws, as does now the new mayor who has come to town. And, you know, they discovered that the state government actually had a lot of information about the poisons in the local water, but really had not done much to alert the public.
And it took how long for him to reach some solution to this? And what in fact did he have to do to get that action taken?
Well, like many of the accidental activists in the book, he learns how to file public records requests. He learns how to enlist support from his neighbors and other people. He learns to network with people around the country who are encountering similar problems. He learns to lobby. Again, he's reluctant, but he learns to lobby state and local officials. He even comes to Washington to testify before a congressional panel. And, you know, these are all skills that you really need the whole package of skills to get public attention. And then, of course, you start dealing with the media. And in that case, there was media attention. In a lot of the other cases I write about, there really is none. But he was able to get coverage, and the community was able to get coverage. One thing that happened to him, and also happens to other people in the book, is that on the one hand, you have the mayor saying, don't tell anybody. And on the other hand, when he discovers he's able to document the problems, he has neighbors who say, why didn't you tell us a long time ago? I mean, you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Yeah. And it was so hard on him. It broke up his marriage.
It certainly, I think, you know, he would say it was a contributing factor. He spent a lot of time on this, and his then wife was just worried, I think, you know, that they were going to become pariahs in the community, and then things sort of devolved from there.
And the end result is the water is cleaner?
Well, the end result is now, after a lot of effort by the community, there is a new water source just recently opened. I think it's open to question whether the aquifer is so poisoned that even this new water source will be enough, but time will tell.
Yeah. And this was not a community that, you know, would be portrayed on TV or in the movies as a downtrodden sort of place. Describe it as, you compare it to perhaps Bedford Falls from the movie It's a Wonderful Life. And you make the point of noting that Grandma Moses is buried there.
Yeah, and she actually used Hoosick Falls for a lot of her paintings. So it is sort of this cute little Victorian-looking town. And, you know, probably with a lot of middle class people. So it's not an impoverished community, but still people had to learn how to combat the problems and, you know, lead the struggle.
Yeah. You know, I broke in as a reporter like you decades ago, covering town and city councils, planning commissions, zoning boards, and school committees for a small daily newspaper in Rhode Island. You know, the types of stories you describe in your book were bread and butter for reporters like me. Where are those reporters now?
Well, you know, we all know about the decline of local news and the rise of news deserts around the country. So, unfortunately, it used to be, I mean, I hung in there, you know, for city council meetings that sometimes went till 2 a.m, which, of course, was when they were making all the things that they didn't, doing all the things they didn't want us to know about, much like what the House of Representatives just did overnight here, having a big meeting about the budget bill that started at 1 a.m. I mean, who does that? Unless you have a reason not, you know, to keep the public in the dark. You know, I think those reporters have gone away. I think those news organizations, except for the very big ones, have gone away. There is a little bit of hope. The New York Times has a local news network that they're cultivating. ProPublica also is doing a lot with trying to work with local reporters. And there are some, you know, there is some growth in the nonprofit area. Of course, it relies on philanthropy at this point.
So you see some sort of coverage like that taking place, because you spent 20 years as an editor and reporter for The Washington Post, including a stint, I understand, as an editor on the Metro desk.
All on the Metro desk. My whole career at the Post was on the Metro desk.
Where you designed deep coverage of undercovered communities in the Metro area. You know, do you still see that kind of coverage at major metros like the Post, which still have large newsrooms? You indicated a minute ago, you mentioned the New York Times, ProPublica. There is some of that, but let's look at our own hometown here.
Well, you know, it's kind of a sad story, I think, at the Post. This is a region of 5 million people. It's bigger than many states. It's bigger than Wyoming. It's bigger than Maine. It transcends, you know, boundaries. So you have multiple governments, multiple budgets. And, you know, unfortunately, and I really date this back to 2013 when Jeff Bezos bought the paper, there's just not a lot of emphasis on local news anymore. And it's, you know, who's going to keep those people accountable?
Yeah, right, right. And there are, it's a big town, but there's also a lot of smaller communities and there's rural areas out just beyond the river and that sort of thing that require that sort of coverage. You know, you provide a playbook for the accidental activist. And what is some of the advice that you offer them?
Well, I think each of the stories, in a way, is a playbook, too. But what I did in the final chapter of the book is try to put it all together in, as you say, as a playbook. So, you know, I think it's sort of a lot of basic stuff that journalists know, but that generally people in the public don't know until they get engaged in some issue. So, you know, first of all, if you think that your government has public records that you need, try to find, you know, go in person if you possibly can. Try to talk to the people who are taking care of those records. Try to learn what they have and how they put them together. And you know, there are sympathetic people in government who can help you craft a request if you need to do an actual public records request. Sometimes if you go in person, people will just give you the information, which they should anyway, but so that's one thing. The other thing, of course, is trying to enlist your neighbors. If you discover a problem, then, you know, politicians, if it's just you going to the politicians and saying, we got a problem, they're going to like, maybe. But if there are 50 people in the community, you go to the city council and say, you know, we think our water is poisoned and we want you to test it. That makes a big difference. I think there's a lot of strength in numbers and you should do a lot to cultivate people who can help you. Plus, it shares the burden of trying to do all this work, which is very hard and takes a lot of time out of your day job.
Yeah, I mean, this is a lot for anyone to take on.
It's very difficult. I mean, I'm the people I wrote about were really just astonishing to me because I caught them at the beginning of their quests and stuck with them for about 4 years. And you know, they are very tenacious. They get frustrated, but they stick with it. And it takes a certain personality, I think, to tough it out like that, but it's really worthwhile.
How did you find them?
Well, you know, whatever the modern day equivalent is of old fashioned shoe leather. So I actually used Facebook a fair amount. It was interesting. There are a lot of these little community groups talking to each other on Facebook or talking to their own community, and some of those you can get to. In the case of the sewer problem in Alabama, and, you know, these are all kitchen table issues, really, that, you know, every day any community might confront. Somebody, they had actually gotten involved in a lawsuit initially against the owner of a landfill and later in an effort to get public records from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which was involved. And so a lawyer who had represented them had written a very short piece for a journal put out by the American Bar Association. I happened to find that piece. I got in touch with her. I told her what I was trying to do, which was to find civilians, not journalists, not lawyers, who were active in their communities. And she led me immediately to this guy, Ben Eaton, who, you know, I've talked to for years now.
What was the sewer problem you're referring to?
Well, it's not solved yet, which is really sad. Some of the issues in the book are more or less resolved, but this one is a community in the Black Belt of Alabama, and that's known both for its soil and for its population, and the name comes from that. They've had overflowing sewers for 40 years, and the community, a very small community, Uniontown, Alabama, got a grant from the federal government, the state government, several years ago for about $5 million. And that, you know, contractor came in and tried to fix it, and they didn't fix it. So then they were lucky to get a lot more money, I think about another $25 million from a lot from the feds, but also some from the state. And, you know, the sewers are still overflowing. They're still not fixed. The money's been spent. And, there's sort of no end in sight. And, of course, when somebody spends $30 million on a community of about 2,000 people, you got to wonder, where's that money going and why didn't it work? And I don't know that we know the answer to that yet.
Yeah. Did you find others in the same situation? Do you continue to look for them?
I do. And, you know, as I've been out talking about the book, and I was in Alabama recently and doing some other book talks around the country, people are coming forward to me and saying, I mean, it's amazing to me in a way how not unique these problems are. You know, people are coming forward with drinking water problems, sewer problems, other kinds of problems, you know, dangerous roads, which is another issue in the book. So I think I hit upon a set of problems that are pretty widespread. And again, it's lack of government transparency that is impeding a lot of progress in this area.
And you continue to look for these stories.
I do. So if there are people listening, please get in touch with me. I'm easy to find.
Yeah. No, it is such a fascinating story. And the lengths that the individuals you wrote about went to work on these problems is fascinating, because so often I think we'll see things on Facebook. People will sort of almost randomly sometimes discuss something that bugs them in their neighborhood, right? But it's sort of an airing of grievances, often without any sort of factual basis, right? Much of it is probably meant well. And I think in this day and age, so much of what we learn about our neighborhoods is from social media.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, not all that we see on social media is by folks like your accidental activist,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's difficult. It creates a lot of disinformation
right.
in communities.
I think that's true. There is a group in Chicago called Documenters, which is training members of the community to go to public meetings and report on them. And they're very specific in the training. You know, no conflicts of interest. You can't be out there pushing for your issue. You need to report accurately, and here's how you do it. And, you know, we'll see how successful that is, but it may be one way to fill the gap that's being left by the yawning chasm in the decline of local news.
Yeah, I agree with you. If only that chasm didn't exist, but it does. And there are people rising to the occasion, as you're writing about here. Well, the book is Backroom Deals in Our Backyards, How Government Secrecy Harms Our Communities and the Local Heroes Fighting Back. The author is Miranda Spivak. Miranda, thank you for joining us today on Update One.
Thanks very much for having me.
You have been listening to Update One, the official podcast of the National Press Club, the world's leading professional organization for journalists and a vigorous advocate of press freedom worldwide. If you have any questions or comments about Update One, send an email to updateonepodcast@gmail.com.